Well, good morning. And everybody in the hallway looking for a great session, come on in. my name is Cable Green. I'm the Director of E-Learning and Open Education at the Washington State Board for Community and Technical Colleges. And I've come today to talk about what we're doing with open education in Washington and specifically our new open policy in Washington. But before I get there, and I want to leave some time at the end to chat, before I get to the policy, I want to tell you about how we got to this in the first place, because the journey itself is interesting, and if you're interested in replicating something like this at your spot, you may want to use some similar steps. So what we started with was about 3 years ago, as we said, we have a problem, and we have a significant problem. And our problem is that we are in the business of learning, and we don't yet fully understand the global trends that are reshaping all service industries in the world, music, newspapers, you name it, right? We know the story. And we're not effectively leveraging those trends, not effectively leveraging digital global networks of knowledge and people to help students learn further and faster. And we all have similar goals, right? We've got Obama's goals. We've got local state goals about how many more people that we need to educate. And we said, we've got a real problem here. We don't understand what's going on. And so we took a look at those trends. And we said further, if we don't understand these trends as a system, and if we don't fully harness the powers of digital network technologies and people to enable learning, our models of higher education in Washington will simply fail. We won't be competitive anymore. We won't even be relevant if we're not understanding these trends and using them. So what are these trends? Very quickly, because I know you're all very aware of these. First one is globalization, right? We're connected in new ways we've never been connected before. Tom Friedman in The World is Flat, that whole part of the story. You all know what this is, right? The little devices that you'd flick them on and they suck 4G or 3G network and they give you a Wi-Fi hotspot. So the next trend is that we're connected in ways that we've never, ever been connected before. Everybody walking around EDUCAUSE has got a smartphone in their pocket, connected to high-speed bandwidth, and you can do pretty much anything you want. That's interesting for us, but what's really interesting is in developing nations all around the world, they're leapfrogging telephone technologies and other sort of pulled fiber and broadband, and they're jumping straight to wireless to cover great expanses, and they're bringing high-speed bandwidth wireless to communities that were never before connected. And so this concept that humanity's connected in new ways is very important, major trend. Next global trend, again, no big surprise, is that we've got a whole bunch of stuff on the Internet. The amount of data, the amount of information, the amount of educational materials that are available online is growing exponentially. I heard somebody from YouTube talking on a TED Talk the other day saying that every day, I think it was 150 years of video is uploaded to YouTube. If you sat down and watched it, that's how long it would take you. So the amount of information is exploding. Anybody read this book, Chris Anderson's The Long Tail? If you haven't, you'll want to take a look at this. So Chris is the editor of Wired magazine, also the curator of TED Talks. And Chris took a step back and looked at all these trends and said, well, what does this mean for industries, for business, for education? And what he came up with was the concept of the long tail. So if you think of the long tail, if you think of the music industry, in the top of the tail you'd have the hits, your top 40 hits, and then you'd have the long tail of the rest of the music that iTunes sells, but maybe only a few songs are sold every month or every year. And so what's different, what Chris talked about, is that when the products and services are digital, that you store everything, you save everything, you want to sell everything, right? Why is that? Well, we all know the costs of storage, distribution, replication of digital objects has essentially fallen to zero. Right, you still got production costs. It still costs a lot of money to build a course or a lot of money to build a textbook. But ask yourself, once that digital textbook is built, how much does it cost you to make a million copies of it? And the answer, for all intents and purposes, is zero. So that was the next big trend that we kind of paid attention to. And then the next trend is participatory technologies or participation. People are able to participate in ways without asking for permission in ways that you never could before in human history. How many of you 10 years ago wanted a website and went and asked permission to your CIO, and what was the answer? It's absolutely not, right? You don't have security clearance. You don't have the skills. There are all sorts of reasons why they were going to be the gatekeeper to that. Today, if you want a website, you go on the web and you build one, and you set up a wiki or a blog or whatever it is that you want to do, and you frankly don't have to ask anymore. Next major trend that we're seeing right now is that all of this stuff that's out there on the web is difficult to access and do anything with, and so these visualization technologies are starting to take hold. And if you haven't seen Gapminder, I'd recommend going to take a look at that. We can play with it a little bit later if you'd like. But, well, just for kicks, let me show you what it is, because it's really neat. Whoops. So here's Gapminder, and I'm just going to put it in motion here. What this is, and you can see the years floating in the background, so 1925, 6. The dots are all, let me pause it for a minute. The dots are all countries, so I could say, let me compare Canada to Illinois, and I can put some trails on it so I can see the data. And what I'm looking at here on the y-axis is infant mortality rate per 1,000 births, and then I've got income per person on the x-axis. And I don't have to keep those variables. I can change those variables to anything that I want. This happens to be United Nations data. All of the United Nations data that they've ever collected on these variables throughout the United Nations history of collecting data. And then I can go ahead and set this into motion, and I can actually see trend lines of mass amounts of data. And the ability to do this, the ability for the average citizen in the world to do this, is a new thing, right, to run these analyses as they're thought up. So back to our industry. We're a little bit unique. When you look at all these trends and you think about higher education, we're a unique industry because we are both the producers and the consumers of the knowledge, right? We produce textbooks, we produce courses, we produce journal articles, we produce data sets, we do all this stuff. And then we, in turn, as an educational community, consume that information. And so this is an image, of how scholarly articles are typically written and consumed, right? You got it at the top. You've got the professor who's trying to get promotion and tenure. You've got one step down his colleagues around the world who are peer reviewing these materials. And by the way, he's doing this to get promotion and tenure, so there's no additional money being paid to this individual. His peers around the world are doing this as part of their quote-unquote service to the academy, and so they're doing it probably at no cost as well. And then the journal publisher, what do they do with the journal? They sell it to your libraries, right? And I don't know about you, but my budgets are getting slashed this year, and they will again in the next biennium, and our libraries are as well. And more, we are unable to afford the journals. And what really drove this one home for me, I was at Ohio State, and a chemistry professor told me, I'm the guy at the top. I have submitted my journal. My journal has been published. My library's budget's been cut. At Ohio State University, we can no longer afford the journal, the chemistry journal, where I just published, and therefore it's illegal for me to go and use my journal article in my class. It's actually against U.S. copyright law. And so think about that for a minute, and this is just flat-out insane behavior, right? It doesn't make any sense because we are the market. And yet, to quote Larry Lessig, the founder of Creative Commons, all of us in the academy have let this insanity happen, and all of us, if we actually stand up and do something about it, can stop it. And this was Larry last year at Educause at one of the keynotes. So here's the risk, and this is what we talked about 3 years ago. The cost of this irrational behavior is not trivial. It's, in fact, very, very high. And these numbers are several billion dollars low. But this is the textbook market for higher education in the United States, excluding online learning, which is 20% of what's happening in the U.S. right now. I've been told by several colleagues that this is somewhere between $3 and $5 billion low, and this number grows at about 2% a year. So this is how much money your students and my students are spending every year on commercial textbooks. So let me use an example from my system. I come from a system of 34 community technical colleges, about 560,000 students. Approximately 47,000 of those students every year are taking English 101, right? You all teach English 101. We teach English 101. We teach a whole lot of English 101. And so do you. It's probably one of your highest enrolled courses. So let's be conservative and say that our students are spending $100 on a textbook. the actual number for top 50 textbooks sold in the U.S. in college bookstores is $129.46. So this is a conservative number. But if I'm close, then just Washington Community Technical College students are spending roughly $4.7+ million a year just on English 101 textbooks, and they're spending that amount of money year after year after year. Now ask yourself, how much are your students spending on English 101 textbooks? And now add that to this number, and now bring in California and Texas and Ohio and New Zealand and everybody else that has this same need, and start to ask yourself, is there a different way to do it? Can we all in this room get together and say, you know what? We all teach English 101. And collectively, we've got a boatload of enrollments, a lot more than 47,000. And how much collective money are our students spending? Can we do something different? And I suggest that we can. So what are we talking about? We're talking about open access. We're talking about open educational resources as one solution to redefining how this market works, where we're both producers and consumers of the knowledge. So, but before we jump into open educational resources and our open policy, why is this concept of open even important? Why should we care? Well, there are several reasons, and people do this for different reasons. And frankly, if you can hook somebody on any of these reasons, that's great. Go where you can get their interest. First one is when we cooperate, we share, we win. Faculty kind of get this one, right? They go to conferences. We go to conferences. The reason you go and present is you want to share. You want other people to take your great ideas. You give poster sessions. You go and you steal other people's ideas at EDUCAUSE. That's why you're sitting here today. You're hoping to learn something that you can take back and it's useful. Right? So we kind of get this in the academy. This one's intuitive. The sub point here I think is really important. The more eyes on a problem, the greater chance for a solution. We got a lot of problems in the world right now. Take your pick, right? If we can expose these problems and make them transparent and open them up, that maybe our chances for a solution go way up. I think a good example of that is the recent BP oil spill. BP had a website out that said, send us all your ideas, but they didn't have the capacity to process those ideas in any sort of efficient way where they got to any solutions. And so how many really great ideas were in that pipeline that never really assisted with the problem, and they sort of solved it in a status quo way, and it took a long time. And I don't know if there were any good ideas or not, but there might have been. Affordability is key, right? Students, raise your hand if your students complain about the high cost of textbooks, right? Our students in the community colleges are, many of them don't have a lot of money. They actually will go to bookstores and they will shop for curriculum based on what they can afford. This is a real problem. In our system, their cost of going to college is about 25% textbooks. In California, it's 50 to 55% textbooks because their tuition is so much lower. Self-interest, and pray on this one if this is where people are interested. I'm kind of a selfish guy, and so one of the reasons why I have Twitter and a blog and I share my slides on slideshare.net and I do all this is because when I share, good things happen to me. I get invitations to write book chapters. I get invitations to go and speak. I get invitations to do great things where I'm networking in a professional community that's vibrant, and I get to learn from other people as well. And so I know from experience when I don't share, nothing happens, right? If you're not sharing, nobody knows you exist. It's the old or the new cliche, if you're not found on Google, you frankly don't exist. And so how do you get on Google searches? You share stuff and people link to it. And the United Nations is coming in at the bottom here saying, look, this is just flat out a social justice issue. When you have digital educational materials that we can openly license using Creative Commons licensing, then frankly we have a moral and ethical obligation to do so. And because more and more communities around the world are connected with broadband connectivity, because the cost of the hardware, the laptops or whatever device you want to use, is dropping and will continue to drop, and we've got open licensing and digital content, we have a recipe for actually bringing higher education to the world's population in a way that was never before possible in human history. And because of that, we've got an obligation to do so. And that's where the United Nations is coming down. Department of Education is getting behind this in a big way. There are several lead folks in the Department of Education led by Undersecretary of Education Martha Cantor. She was previously the chancellor at Foothill De Anza Community College District. And she and Secretary Duncan and others are very supportive of this idea of openness, of sharing materials that are produced so that others can benefit from them and more people can become educated in the United States and beyond. So this is the definition that they've been chewing on over the summer and that they will use in Department of Education grants. So look at the next DOE grant that you're looking at and you'll see recommendations, encouragement to say specifically that you will open up and share whatever it is that you produce with the DOE grant, and it'll give you more points in the grant when you do that. And so this is what they mean by open. Teaching and learning resources reside in the public domain or have been released under an intellectual property license that permits free use or repurposing by others. Right. This is my own personal goal in our system. Why are we engaged in open education? Because we're community colleges. We're interested in increasing access and completion, right? Helping people complete once they're in. By providing high-quality, affordable, openly licensed educational materials. So when we're talking about openly licensed, if you're not familiar with Creative Commons licensing, you need to be. Go to creativecommons.org and start looking at it. And the license, if you haven't picked a license yet, the one that I'd highly, very strongly recommend is called Creative Commons Attribution, or CC BY is what you'll see, the CC and then the BY after it. And the reason for that is that it's a very open license that lets other people do many things with your content, mainly change it, revise it, adjust it, and then reuse it and share it with others. So getting to our policy now, we've got a long history of sharing already in our system, which was very helpful to this conversation. For about 12 years, we've been sharing essentially an entire AA degree online among our 34 colleges and other modules as well, so that was helpful. About 3 years ago, we started what we called our strategic technology plan, and we said two big things in it. The first thing we said was, we're not going to do enterprise technologies 34 different ways. We are going to do them once for all 34 colleges. We're going to fund them centrally. And by the way, I see people taking notes. These slides are, if you go to the session on EDUCAUSE's program for this site, I've put up links to the strategic technology plan. I've put the slides up there. And I've also put our policy up there, our open policy, so you don't have to write any of that down. But we said two things. We're going to share common technologies. And then in the same breath, we said, by the way, we have an opportunity, because we're on common technology systems, to share digital content. And there's this whole global open educational resources conversation going on that today our system is not part of. And that's going to be a real problem for us. And strategically, we need to both share what we are creating with other people, and we need to take all the good stuff that California and New Zealand and France and Kentucky are creating, and we need to take a look at it and use it in-house if it's good, if it's quality, if it meets our needs, right? So we said those things. We said this is mostly not a technological problem. It's a cultural shift issue, right? And so we said we're going to cultivate a culture and practice of using and contributing to open educational resources. But then we said in the same breath, this is hard. This requires a significant change in the culture of higher education. Even though the academy understands publishing and sharing and building on the shoulders of others and citing people and giving credit for work, we get that. The concept of actually saying, here's my course, take it, or here, I built this textbook, please use it and revise it, is a little bit foreign to us because we've gotten sold on the idea that we should lock up our content in copyright and own it, and my course is what makes me great as a professor, and so I'm not going to share it with you because I don't want you to be as great as I am, or for whatever reason. And that's completely counter to what the academy believes, and if you sit down and have a one-on-one with a faculty member, they will say, of course you can, I want to share, and of course I want you to benefit from what I do and vice versa. And so it's really not that difficult, but it does require the conversation. And it does require thinking about content as a common resource that as we share, as we iteratively improve on it, all of us do better, right? So go back to that English 101 example again. So a few things that we've done recently is we've been tweaking Washington legislation. So there was we had some code on the books that said that faculty should consider least costly textbooks when reviewing textbooks for courses, and we added the text in red. They should also look at open textbooks when available. They should work with college librarians to put together course packs, collections of free online resources, copyright-clear journal articles, right? Create current quality materials that are significantly more affordable than a $150 textbook. We also have new legislation from a couple sessions ago that says essentially to for all of public higher education in Washington to do what the CTCs did in their strategic technology plan, which was both to look at sharing enterprise technologies and to look at effectively sharing digital content. And it got specific. Look at open courseware, open textbooks, open journals, open learning objects, et cetera. The list went on. So we're in that conversation right now, and that report will be given back to the legislature this December. If you're looking for strategy, it's really simple. Here it is. If you want to partner with your legislators, you ask them, do you care about efficient use of state tax dollars? They will say yes. And you say, do you care about the students in this state and saving them money and helping them go to college? And they will say yes. And you say, do I have a deal for you? In our state, and then you get your numbers out. In our state today, students are spending X million on English 101, on psychology 101, on sociology 101, et cetera. And there are states, Washington, you can point to, who are willing to partner with us to do this in a different way so that our students can afford to go to college and we can start to take textbook costs off the table. And our faculty can start to engage the open courseware and the open modules and all the open data that's available to bring into our teaching and learning environments to enrich further what they already do. So another potent force in our state are the students, right? The students have a very organized group called the Student Voice Academy, and they get together multiple times throughout the year, all the student body leaders, and they set their legislative agenda, and then they actually go and write bills for the legislature. And number one issue on their list for the top 3 years, and I've only been in Washington for 3 years, has been textbooks and the cost of textbooks. And they've told me point blank, you get this fixed or it's not coming off the top of our list. And they're quite angry about it, as they should be. So what are we doing about it? We've got these ideas. We said, this is really important. And then we said, well, what do we do next? And we said as a system, we need something we can really sink our teeth into. So we went to the Gates Foundation and our state legislature, and we said, we want to do a big project. We want to design digitally in a modular fashion and openly license with CC BY licensing from Creative Commons, essentially our entire general education curriculum. So we're designing right now, we're in the first phase of this, our top 81 highest enrolled courses. They will be digital. Doesn't mean they have to be taught online. They certainly could be taught face-to-face, hybrid, or blended. There's a lot of ways to deliver this material. And one of the requirements is that the required instruction materials cannot be more than $30. So we went out to Flat World Knowledge. You all know Flat World. We went to all the major commercial publishers. We went to Pearson and McGraw and Cengage and BFW and all of them. And we said, this project is not about putting you out of business. This project is not vindictive against your business model. We simply are going to leverage the global trends and do better than we are today by our students. And we'd love to partner with you, but the price of admission for your participation is that you've got to get under $30. And at first, we got laughed out of the room in many cases by the publishers. And then they came back and said, look, we see that the world is changing. We too see these trends. We saw what happened in newspapers. We saw what is happening to the music industry and the movie industry and others. We understand that change is coming, and we do want to partner and be part of this project. And so we're working with them right now. And you all may benefit from that because they are thinking about new models, about how to get their materials under $30, so that our faculty teams will actually choose them for these designs. So we're doing the first 44 courses right now. You'll have access to our first 44 highest enrolled courses next summer, fall, probably fall of 2011. We're going to do the second half from fall of 11 to fall of 12, and then we'll move forward from there. Just a few numbers on savings for our system. You can see of the 560,000 students we've got, and these numbers are low, it's actually about 450,000 of those enrollments take these 81 courses. You'll find the same numbers if you run the data in your systems, right? 80% of your students take your top 100 courses. All of them do. and there's significant savings if these courses are adopted. And this is an important, really important piece. You don't want to, if you start to talk about open educational resources, the first group you want to engage in a positive way is, of course, faculty. Faculty are the folks that are going to drive this. They're the ones that are going to start to look at open educational resources and say, there's a real opportunity here for me to enrich my learning environment and control academic freedom in a way that I've never had an opportunity to before. So if you think about it in those terms, think about if you're a faculty member and what you do today for your materials is primarily use a textbook and the supplemental materials that come with that textbook. What you're doing is being very much driven by the textbook and those materials, and sure, you're doing other things in your classroom. But contrast that with open materials that are available on a global scale that are being constantly updated by your community of peers in your discipline, and it's a different conversation, right? The negative side of that for some faculty is, wait, this might be a threat to my academic freedom, and I think that's a very easy conversation to have and to counter, because in fact, open educational resources is absolutely not about mandating anything. In fact, quite the opposite. Think about open educational resources as more choice than you've ever had before, a big buffet that you're going to, and you're choosing and picking from what it is that you'd like to use. So for what you came for, what's our new policy? Our new policy that we settled into this summer is that all digital software, educational resources, and knowledge produced through competitive grants, and this is a key word, not all formula-driven money that flows through our board and the legislature to colleges, but only competitive grants that are offered through and or managed by the State Board for Community and Technical Colleges will carry a Creative Commons attribution license. So what does this mean? This means that if you're a college in our system or some other entity in the state that wants to get a grant from the State Board, regardless of fund source, it could be state funds that we're giving out grants, it could be federal funds, it could be foundation funds, but if it comes through our agency, as many of the competitive grants do for our system, you have to agree to share whatever it is that you produce. You don't like those terms? Don't apply for the grant. It's that simple. And by the way, we are not the first ones out of the gate with this. The federal government has been doing this for years with the National Institutes of Health, where if you've taken an NIH grant and you produce data sets and then journal articles, you had a 12-month window to do whatever you wanted with it, but then after 12 months, you had to open it up and go open access with it. The many other federal agencies are starting to adopt similar policies. The foundations are starting to require openness. Was anybody at yesterday's Next Gen Learning Challenges briefing by Ira Fuchs? You probably heard requirements of CC BY licensing in that discussion, right? This is going to become more and more something that's common. So this is one of my favorite guys. And Lincoln, in 1862, 1 month before he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, he sent a long message to Congress. And in that, he said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so must we think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." And so I think the big question for us today, knowing all these global trends, knowing what's possible with digital network technologies and the expertise that you all have in the room and at your campuses, we've got to ask, can we disenthrall ourselves and our campuses and institutions from our current thinking, our current business models, our current practices, and ask new questions? So what kind of decisions will lead us to optimal use of technologies, content and talent to support student achievement, not just for Washingtonians, you can see I forgot to change that, but for all citizens, starting with American citizens, but we're talking about global citizens when we're having this conversation. In our system, we said, look, we've got a strong structure as a system, and so we've got something we can build upon. And we started asking questions. What would happen to the quality of our curriculum, especially our gen ed curriculum, if all system digital content was shared and our course redesign was data-driven? What would happen to the quality of our curriculum? I don't know, but we're talking about it. Can we use technologies and shared content to significantly improve completion rates? We think so. We're talking to Carnegie Mellon and others right now. Anybody know Carnegie Mellon Open Learning Initiative? Have you seen this? Oh, well, here, you learned something great today, right? You didn't learn anything from Cable, but you learned this. So this is a great thing. You want to take a look at it. Carnegie Mellon got a bunch of money over the years from the Hewlett Foundation and other sources. And what they've built are a set of courses that have embedded in them assessments, and they collect data on every move that students are making. And so let me use an example. They've got a course, Intro to Statistics. You all teach it. We teach it. And as the students are going through Intro to Statistics, they are actually capturing transaction-level data on your students. They know where your students are getting tripped up, assessments along the way, and the students don't get it right away. There's a hint, and the system is tracking how many hints it took to be successful. And then the students are getting new problem sets, and they're getting directed so that they're successful. The faculty have all this data as well in the aggregate on their class. And I think I'm cutting out here if you guys have a new mic. In the aggregate on the class and on individual students, right? So they can, as the student walks into class the next day, the faculty member can say, James, thanks for coming to class. By the way, I can see in the last week that you've really been struggling with probability. And so could you stay after class for 5 minutes? And I know, because I have the data, exactly where James is having problems. That's a new tool for faculty that they've never had before. And not only that, but Carnegie Mellon's done research on their courses, and they're getting these kinds of results, which I can't replicate. I can't build courses that do this. And because their courses are open and I can go use them, the question is, should I try? Or should I adopt what somebody else has funded and been willing to create and share with me? For us, the answer is obvious. We should be open-minded and humble enough to use somebody's stuff like this so that we can get these kinds of results. So completing the same amount of materials in half the time, learning 33% more content and getting better standardized test scores. And then the last one is the kicker for community technical colleges, because we're always talking about completion rates. They've run multiple courses at universities, state colleges, community colleges, and this was one of the studies they did on completion rates. How do they get 99% completion rates? Because the design of the courses are really mastery level courses. I liken it to being in basic training in the Army. It may take you 5 hours to learn how to disassemble that weapon, but you're going to sit there in the mud until you figure it out, and I'm going to keep helping you until you figure it out, but you're not going to go home and go to sleep until you know how to disassemble and reassemble that weapon, right? And that's kind of the approach they use in the courses. They keep giving you hints until you get the problem and you figure it out. So big questions. What if we had free and openly licensed textbooks? What if we had an English 101 textbook that was free, cost you nothing, and it was open so that where are you from in the front row right here? From the Netherlands. Oh, and the Netherlands is actually one of the leaders in open education, by the way. They're way ahead of the United States. But what if in the Netherlands they created an open English 101 textbook because they also teach English, and we adopted it in Washington and changed it. Maybe they translated into Dutch. Maybe I translated into Spanish because we've got a huge influx of Spanish-speaking students, and they've got some Spanish foreign exchange students. All of a sudden, we have the same textbook translated into three languages, and we did it because we did it for our own needs, but then we shared it back with each other, and others could benefit from it. Anybody seen what California's been doing with K-12 open textbooks recently? If you want to see specifics, I've got links in my PowerPoint. You can download it later. But essentially, they are dropping open textbooks into the top of their review funnel for reviewing commercial textbooks, and either they're making it through on their own merits or they're not, and either they meet state standards or they don't. But what's happening is tens of open textbooks are making it through and can be adopted by K-12 districts. It's already saving California tens of millions of dollars a year compared to what they used to spend. And we think they've got some budget problems here in California, yeah, that they're needing to solve. Other questions. What if all state-funded or country-funded, and this is where the Netherlands is having a conversation around country-funded educational content, what if it was open access? The big idea here is the last bullet point. Can we start to think about publicly funded educational materials being open to the people that paid for it? Now think about that for a minute. If you're walking down the street and you walk up to a citizen in Anaheim, California, and you say, you're a taxpayer in Anaheim, California, we've got community colleges right around the corner, your taxes went to pay for courses that we're building at this community college. Do you think that you have a legal right or any right to have access to what it is that you paid for? What do you think that individual is going to say? And this is the concept that public entities, public governments are starting to ask globally. And this is where our new policy came from. So let me stop talking and do a quick time check here. How are we doing on time? We got about 15 minutes. So I wanted to keep it short, and let me put my information up here. And we can talk. And I can get up out of this Barca lounger. Yeah. Yeah, so I'll repeat the question. Do we have another wireless mic that we can pass around? No? So there's a... Here, let me throw this one out here. This one works. So here, let me have you repeat the question, because we're recording.
Cable. Dr. Green.
Yes.
What are the barriers? It makes sense on paper. It makes intuitive sense. It makes a political sense in many ways to be able to do this. What are some of the barriers that you're seeing that you're doing a great job in Washington? What's keeping it from that dissemination point, from being able to replicate and scale up?
It's a good question. So there are a lot of barriers. And why are there a lot of barriers? Because this is a disruptive idea. We're using disruptive technologies. We're disrupting business models. There are forces on both sides that are on say commercial publishers who are not interested in this conversation and don't want to see it happening. So there's all sorts of barriers. But those are frankly not the challenging barriers. The challenging barriers, in my opinion, are that there is a lot of information and material shared today on the web that are openly licensed, that are lower quality. Not necessarily low quality text, but maybe they don't have the great images and the simulations and the test banks and all the supplemental materials that we're used to in using textbooks as an example, right? Let's use academic journals as an example. We still got barriers because there are a lot of faculty that just flat out don't know about open access journals. And really all they care about is getting a promotion and tenure and furthering their field and knowledge. And to do that, they want to publish in the best journals in their field. And in many cases, the best journals in their field are not open access. And so, you know, many of us are pushing on those journals to say, look, if your goal is to disseminate knowledge, when you have open access, you reach that goal a lot faster. We all know that if there's a paper that we want to read, a resource we want to access, if we can link to it and we can get to it easily on the web, it's used much, much more because you share that link and you post it and you blog about it, right? And all of a sudden it goes viral and people can get access to it. If there's a closed resource, I mean, how many times have you gone to an article on the Chronicle or the Times or something that somebody sent you a link and you don't have a subscription? Do you go buy a subscription to get to it? No, you say, hey, stop sending me things that I don't have subscriptions to, or send me the short-term link, right? So it doesn't get read. And there's some great research from the American Research Librarians Association that shows open access journals get read tremendously more than closed access journals. Let me harp on the quality issue a little bit more. It's not just the quality of the content, but remember how there's one of the trends was there's so much stuff on the web. If you're a faculty member, you're already very, very busy, right? You're completely tapped out, and somebody comes to you and says, hey, great news. There's this world of open educational resources that you should go find. Textbooks, you should go find simulations of courses, and they say, when in the world, do I have time to do that? And where do I go to search? Make it easy for me. And today we say to them, hey, guess what? There's 400 big global repositories with open stuff. You go look in them. And they say, forget that. It's not going to happen. And so we in the open community, all of us who are interested in this, have to make it just fall off a log simple to have federated searches for faculty to say, I teach intermediate algebra. That's what I want to find. So when they search on it, it comes right up and they get good results. But that's not enough, right? Because how do they know if it's any good? We need to, in my opinion, to steal some of the technologies that already exist. And when I say steal, I mean partner. We need to work with Amazon.com to get their review system and their recommendation system. So you go to Amazon, you buy a book, and it says, you might also like these books. We don't have anything like that in higher education, right? We need, you took intro to, and I'll go to you next. You took intro to intermediate algebra. Your colleagues also, who took that, also took this course and really liked it. We need the reputation system from eBay. So anybody ever bought anything on eBay? Right? You don't buy on price often because usually there's 500 of the exact same item. So how do you buy? You buy on people's reputation because you're worried about buying from somebody that you don't know. And so you trust them based on, you know, how many stars they have. And so I want to, you know, I know that James is a great biology scholar. And so, and I'm a biology professor, and James has never recommended anything to me that's turned me wrong. And so his reputation is going to go up in the community. We don't have those tools to make it easy for faculty to say, ah, I can zero in and find the thing I want. We're getting there. We're starting to build them, but we're not there yet. Huge barriers. Yeah.
Well, you brought me to today. This is one of the reasons why I came today, because I had an open conversation with a bunch of faculty at my college. And they were saying, Mike, we have no idea whether this crap is – no offense, but this open source stuff is going to work for us. So what one of my faculty said, I need you to talk to Cable and tell him, get some kind of rating system. I mean, if we're going – you know, get a bunch of – put stars out there, some wibbly-wibblies, whatever you want. But get those people out there that are using this product to start rating it so I can sit there and narrow my focus without having to sit there and sift through all this, because it's not going to happen at my desk at my time, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Absolutely. And it's so in Merlot, for example, big referatory, it's been online for over a decade. They've had the star system for a long time, right? And but even that's not enough, because you ask – so think about MIT OpenCourseWare, right? MIT scholars putting their stuff out there. It's really great, but at Pierce Community College District, where Mike's from in Washington, they might look at that and go, gosh, this looks like good stuff, but it's not really appropriate at the level of where I'm teaching students in first semester engineering. MIT's up here. I'm teaching right here at this point, and my students are going to get there. But so does it mean it's not quality? No, it just means it's not useful, right? So, but you're not going to get that in a star system, but you're going to get it in reviews. You're going to get it in recommendations. You're going to get it in other forms. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, what they're saying, though, is have a system where the community colleges are rating. Have a system where universities are rating. Have a system where the graduate and whatever. But some kind of system where I know who I am. I'm going to that rating system, and I'm seeing that, hey, listen, in Washington State, X number of folks have rated this as A-plus material.
Absolutely. And one of the things we didn't talk about is, but you all know about, is there are big grants coming online right now. That have focuses on sharing materials. So there's an NSF grant that's out right now, $30 million on cyber learning. There's the Gates Foundation has two big grants out right now. Next Gen Learning Challenges was talked about in the last 2 days. It's now online. Four categories. OpenCourseWare is one of them. The use of data analytics is another one. So, I mean, there's Gates money right now to do exactly what you're talking about. The Department of Labor has got $2 billion coming online at the end of October. And that money is going to be targeting community technical colleges. And one of the requirements of that grant is whatever's produced, CC BY license. Yeah.
Sorry. One other idea that they came up with was, you know, if they're going to use it, they're obligated to rate it. So if they take it, check it out, then after they've done it, they've got to rate it. And it doesn't, but you make it simple. Something, so they just click a box.
Use one, rate one. Yeah. Other questions? Yes. If you can come grab the mic, that'd be great. Thank you.
Hi. I work for Pearson, and so I'm one of the publishers. And I've been in publishing for over 20 years. I do an emerging online product strategy. And there are a lot of issues, obviously. And big publishers like Pearson, McGraw-Hill, Cengage, we're all in the, you know, really the same boat, right? We can't just simply tear down what we've built over the last 50 years. We can't just go around and, you know, all of a sudden fire 20,000 people in order to drop prices, you know, 60, 70, 80%. So I'm searching, and I think a lot of my colleagues are too, searching for ways to make the transition. We are in, you know, there's no question. We're right at the chasm, so to speak. We know that. It's not news to us. So we're all searching for ways to cross that and partner, you know, so on and so forth. And so I'm very eager to hear, you know, ideas for partnerships, for collaboration. But keeping in mind that, you know, we have to at the same time turn this massive battleship and make it a lot, you know, leaner, a lot slicker, and at the same time. Very, very difficult to do. Very difficult. And a lot of management folks in the business school would probably argue that, you know, some of the incumbents just simply won't survive, will just be disruptive out of the business. And that's certainly possible. But I would like to say that, and I can't speak for McGraw-Hill or Cengage, but I can certainly speak for Pearson. There are certainly a lot of people who want to make the change, trying to make the change. And no doubt, culturally speaking, there's probably just as many, if not maybe more, that don't. But, you know, that's all part of the culture of any incumbent business. But, you know, I'm certainly eager to hear any ideas you guys have for change.
Sure. Well, I mentioned, and then others can jump in too with ideas, please. I mentioned that with our Open Course Library project, one of the first things that our faculty said once they were part of the grant and they were on the design teams is they said, hey, we love this idea of open educational resources. And I have spent the last week looking at, 50 open textbooks in my field, and none of them stack up to the level of quality that I am willing to put in front of my students at this point. I know it's coming, and maybe if I combine these 50, I'd have something good, but it's not there yet. And so they said, Cable, we have to be able to work with publishers in this project. And I said, you're right. Quality is paramount. We cannot have open garbage is no good, right? That doesn't do anybody any good. And so I picked up the phone, and we called Pearson and Cengage and McGraw and BFW and everybody else and said, we want to partner with you on this project. Now, yes, you're going to have to get it at a $30 price point, and yeah, that's going to be a challenge, and we've worked through a lot of that. So the first point I would say is that quality has got to be number one. That's where we start in the conversation. Two, I think that there's a huge opportunity for publishers moving forward as we start in the move of this bigger model that I mentioned about using public funds to produce public goods. Clearly, the money is already being spent. Over $10 billion in higher ed on textbooks. So the money's there, right? It's being spent by students. It's being spent by state financial aid, federal financial aid, et cetera. So the money is there. So now the question is, are we spending the money in the most effective way? I would argue strongly no. And I would also suggest that we should partner with whoever can do the best job building the best textbooks. And who is that today? Well, come on, it's the publishers. It's the commercial publishers. So I think, you know, so Mike and I are deal with technology a lot. We launch RFPs and we outsource a lot of technologies. I think one of the answers is we outsource a lot of the creation of the textbooks to the commercial publishers. We will probably launch in the near future an RFP for an English 101 textbook. Right? And when I say we, I'm not talking about just Washington. I'm talking about a national coalition and probably an international coalition with a good chunk of money. We might put $1 million on it. We might put $2 million on it. And we might say to the publishers of the world, who wants to produce this English 101 textbook? Bid on it. It's a competitive bid. Now the catch, so the good news to the publishers is, hey, great, here's an income stream to serve your existing battleship that you're slowly moving, right? So we're not cutting off the revenue stream. There's still a lot of money there. But you're not going to get to own it. So you, Pearson, if you win the bid, you don't hold the copyright. The copyright is held by the U.S. federal government or the state of Washington or Rio Grande Community College in Arizona. Frankly, I don't care who owns the copyright as long as there's a CC BY license on it so that the Netherlands can grab it and use it if they want to. Or so if Texas can take it and modify it, or Pierce College District can take it, and Mike and his crew can tweak it, and his faculty can modify it to meet their needs. And so that's different, right? Pearson now has to say, okay, We've got the expertise, the people, the vault of content, the ability to create simulations, all the great stuff that Pearson can do. But we have to understand that we don't get to own things going forward, and we aren't going to have those gates on the content anymore. And that's where, you know, people like me and others will take the conversation. And the publishers, I think, that are willing to change their business models and adapt to things like that, and there will be other models, but that's a big one, will be very successful. The ones that don't and say, no, we will always own it, and, you know, you're going to have problems. Anybody else want to share?
Yeah. At a much more prosaic level, I certainly agree with Cable and support that goal and those ideas. I think, though, at a much more prosaic level, some of the things that Pearson's already engaged in, I think, are right on, and that is disaggregating content from the entire textbook and saying to faculty, here are chunks, here are individual units, here are individual chapters that you can use and mix with what you already have or with what you discover in OER repositories. So the more mobile and malleable the content is, the more likely that I think individual faculty members are going to bring it into the mix broadly.
I've got another idea that was posed to me by one of my faculty members, and I spent a lot of time talking to my faculty trying to get ahead of what their trends are, what they're thinking about. But one of the things that they brought up was that maybe you take something, a rift on the iTunes model, something where you put some money into it. It doesn't have to be your particular company, but you're getting together with the other publishers and you're putting together another subsidiary or another company that works off of, let's get ahead of the ball game. Let's filter through that online open content. Let's take a hard look at this content and let's take ownership of that. Let's just don't let this content beat us up. Get out there and say, okay, this is what we see as the best open content. And, oh, by the way, we think we're in competitive here. Here's some books from these from that you might want to look at too. Whereas you're building a website that is trying to get that content to the faculty and also saying to them, hey, you know, if this is not your, this doesn't work for you. If this is the highest rated material and this doesn't work for you, by the way, here's a book that we can sell you at X cost. But take ownership of it. Go out there and anybody can grab it. So you grab it and you use your own research people, the people that you guys already got the expertise at looking at this material and knowing what the best material really is. So take that material and sit through it. Yeah, it's going to cost money, but at the same time, too, if you start grabbing it and taking ownership of it, and you can probably help out and steer us to some of the better material that's out there.
And the comment I always make when, because this is a big conversation, right? But for me, there's a very clear bottom line and goal. And frankly, and I mean this when I say it, I don't care how we get to this goal. I really don't. Working with the publishers, working without the publishers, I don't care. But the goal for me is to get to high quality, affordable instructional materials for students so we can increase access and lower the cost of higher education for anybody who wants to go to college. And if we can work together to do that with publishers, right on. I think that's where we got to go.
Rita Salato, College in Tempe, Arizona. We actually have a partnership with Pearson where we've customized the textbooks. And with that, how are you doing? We are able to reduce the cost by about 50 to 60%. So what we do is we say we're going to look at this. We have a team of faculty go through and say, we took this, we're going to stay with this because we're not going to go with edition changes, and we're going to hold on to that edition, and we're able to do that. You know, that said, 50% is really good, but I compare it to what's going on with my cell phone. So I can turn my cell phone into a broadband internet access, and I can pay Verizon basically $1 to $1.50 a day for that access, about $35 a month. Or I can pay $14 once, download an app, and turn my cell phone into a Wi-Fi hotspot. And I never have to pay that again. So I think what Rio's done with Pearson is very good because there's a limited shelf life, we know, with content. Now, some things don't change. I mean, Spanish literature has not changed in about 500 years. That's why, you know, Cervantes and Don Quixote does really well. But it's in the public domain also. There are other areas that I don't will be very difficult, and I think that's where publishers will make greater money. For example, in computer science courses, in the newest programming languages and things like that, there will always be really cutting edge that we won't be able to get together as in the public sector to be able to pull that as fast and as quickly unless there's a higher level of organization. But I do think it's a longer shelf life. But I do think the publishers have, and I agree with Cable absolutely, they have the best quality right now. And it's maybe not in the original product, but it may be the ancillary items, the additional materials that are creating the the value added for that student. So I download from my iTunes, you know, I download that song I really like, but then, you know, where did that come from? That came from that TV show. Ah, I think I'll go out and download that TV show or that episode. Oh, I like that. You know, I want the whole series. I want the whole season. So I do that, and I think that might be something. It's, you know, as it moves along, but I do think it's a limited shelf life for certain courses. I think these top, you know, 50, top, you know, 100 courses, that's doable.
And we're out of time, so just one final bit of advertisement. The three of us up here in the front are part of something called the Community College Consortia for Open Educational Resources, and we're all board members of that group. If any of you are community colleges or are interested in community college education, maybe you've got a lot of transfer students that come to your institution, and you're interested in open educational resources, it's a group that you might want to join, come to the meetings. They're all online. It's a very open and welcoming group, and one of the things that we're doing is actively seeking grants and other state support, et cetera, to do these kinds of activities. And it's forming up to be a global coalition to do exactly that. We also partner with groups like the Open Courseware Consortium, which is universities doing the same thing. So this is a global movement. It is, I hate to use the term, but it really is at a tipping point right now. And the amount of money, the $2.5 billion or so that's about to be dumped into this space is going to make a big impact. So I thank you very much for coming out early on a Friday morning. All of this stuff is online and downloadable at the session site, and please contact me if anybody has additional questions.